And thank you for listening to the Nordic Africa podcast, a series of pod conversations about current trends and issues in Africa. I'm Henrik Alfvesson, and sitting here next to me is my colleague Heba Habib, who will introduce today's episode.
Recently, China's new foreign minister, Ken Gang, finished his first official visit overseas in Africa, where he visited five countries, Ethiopia, Gabon, Benin, Angola, and Egypt. His visit is in keeping with a long tradition for 33 years now, the first official overseas visit every year for all Chinese foreign ministers has been to Africa. In this episode of the Nordic Africa podcast, we will try to map China's interests in Africa and how these are met by the African Union and by African countries. With us here to discuss these questions are
Fantu Chero, senior researcher at the African Studies Center at Leiden University in the Netherlands and former research director at the Nordic Africa Institute. Lisa Laxo, senior researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute, and John Obey, senior lecturer in global politics and international relations at Malmö University in Sweden.
So for our first question, before we get to the heavier questions, let's start with a more trivial but still mind-tricking one. As mentioned in the introduction, it's been 33 years now that the first official overseas visit every year for China's foreign ministers has been to Africa. What conclusions can we draw from this tradition? John, maybe you have some thoughts?
Yeah. Well, what conclusions can we draw? Well, the fact that China maintains this tradition is, of course, a sign of continuity. So in that sense, Xingang's visit is not so special, I would say. If the tradition would have been disrupted by China suddenly choosing another continent, then that would have been significant because it would have meant a disruption to the custom. But apart from being an habitual diplomatic exercise, it shows that China places a very high symbolic significance on the relationship with African countries, I would say. So it shows the importance of Africa to China diplomatically, economically, strategically, and so on. And that Africa is an important source of much needed natural resources, primarily actually, but it's also a growing export market. And it also shows that China is eager to maintain and strengthen those ties. And perhaps especially so now after the COVID pandemic and the fact that China just opened up again. That is basically it, I would say. But we can, I mean, normally China-Africa relations is interpreted as being mainly about trade, investment, infrastructure construction, economic development, and so on. And that is in many ways true. But I don't think we can ignore that Gang's visit took place when political tensions and strategic competition between the United States and China and this new so-called Cold War rhetoric is on everybody's lips. So he's visiting Africa against this backdrop, and that's important to take into consideration. And he also referred to this when he was traveling around Africa, saying that Africa needs solidarity and cooperation, and that Africa should not be an arena for major country competition, that no one should force African states to take sides, and so on. So in that sense, the strategic competition between US and China, I would say, is contributing to new interpretation of this tradition, at the moment at least.
Speaking of backdrop, of course we can't discuss China's geopolitical ambitions with putting it to the backdrop of the Belt and Road Initiative, a global infrastructure development project into which China has already invested $1,000 billion almost. Africa is the largest regional component of this project. The 46 African nations that have signed onto it comprise over 1 billion inhabitants and cover about 20% of the landmass of the entire Earth. So far, how has this initiative affected Sino-African relationships? Fantu, maybe?
Oh, definitely. I think Chinese engagement since, I would say, 2001 particularly, has been growing exponentially in many ways. But on the other hand, I think the empirical evidence also shows that China's influence has not substantially altered the fundamentals in Africa. In other words, structural transformation has yet to happen, despite increased Chinese investment in transport, energy, communication, and manufacturing. Sub-Saharan Africa has yet to see tangible economic development benefit in terms of long-term structural transformation. The productive capacities still remain at a very low level. External trade is dogged by the same problems as during the colonial era, with primary commodities dominating exports to China, industrial or manufacturing product dominating imports from China, thereby leaving the region exposed to external economic shocks. So in many ways, yes, there have been significant activities on the part of China, not only just China, really. One have to add in here Turkey and India, particularly in that sense. But there's a lot of project-based activity, mostly on infrastructure. But at the end of the day, how this investment from China produced tangible result is when individual countries have a long-term strategic vision of development. This investment alone are not going to make a difference unless there is a reciprocal a long-term vision strategy on the part of the African government. The countries that have done that have actually taken advantage of the investment and trade that has come from China.
So speaking of India and Turkey, you mentioned, I guess there would also be some other countries we could mention, but what's their relationship to the Belt and Road Initiative? Is there like a situation of competition, or are different actors playing along together on this project?
Not so much cooperation, there is competition, but also the, you know, trying to take advantage of what China may have invested by other actors such as Turkey. So they can, you know, be easy riders to the Chinese project, or in some areas they can also be in competition with China, as the case of Turkey with regard to the building of rail transport in Ethiopia and Port Sudan connecting to Khartoum, all that activity. So it was both competition as well as cooperation, you see. It's not a clear-cut situation.
Lisa and John, do you have something to add to say to this Belt and Roads initiative and how it affects Sino-African relationships?
Should I go?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I have my reservations against those figures. And I have my reservations against the Belt and Road Initiative as well, because, I mean, everything nowadays is Belt and Road Initiative.
Yes.
And if everything is Belt and Road Initiative, nothing is really Belt and Road Initiative.
Exactly.
Negates itself. So in some sense, the BRI, to me, becomes, you know, more or less the same as the sum total of everything China does. Mm-hmm. So, and also when it comes to that $1 trillion US dollars, much of that is headlines, and even in the CARI loan data that we can find, it's a really good database by Johns Hopkins University. I think they moved to Boston now, though. But I mean, even there, it says committed figures, because it's really hard to check how much that has actually been distributed. So I have my reservations against that. But of course, it is true that, I mean, the big bulk of Chinese lending to Africa is in relation to infrastructure, in relation to transport, power generation, and even 5G networks, ICT. And those are really significant numbers, I would say. And it is very important. China is a very important player, perhaps the most important player on the African continent when it comes to infrastructure, indeed. But yeah, I have my reservations against the actual figures and the BRI itself as a concept.
I agree, John. Mm. You're right on target.
Yes. I was also thinking that if Belt and Road Initiative is that kind of umbrella, indeed, it also covers cooperation in higher education, for instance, and scholarships for African students, and that kind of projects, of course, are something that are getting visibility in the high-level meetings. I mean, new figures in every FOCA meeting announced about that kind of mobility programs. But I would agree that it's difficult to evaluate their significance within the Belt and Road Initiative itself.
Mm.
Fantastic. So here in Europe, we often compare China-Africa policies with EU-Africa policies, but the comparison lopsided. The EU is a union of 27 democracies with different languages, foreign policies, historic ties, and so on. Whereas China is one country ruled by an authoritarian leader or slash elite, with more than triple the population of EU. So how do these differences in democratic rule and size play out when it comes to building relationships or grabbing for influence in Africa?
Well, of course, Europe as a region still is the most important or significant partner for African continent.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the figures in trade, cooperation, even security policy. But But what is different is that China can coordinate its policies in a much more effective way, I would say, than the heterogeneous European partner. Because, and particularly in projects like those ones concerning infrastructure mentioned by Fantu, for instance. So if the state authorities are negotiating about the project, China can bring private companies along, and also the banks that can finance the project. So in that sense, it is a very powerful actor because of this ability to coordinate the different stakeholders on the Chinese side. But then a big difference, of course, is that China frequently says that it is an all-weather friend, an all-weather partner, meaning that it does not want to interfere in the internal political issues, human rights or democracy, which on the part of the European Union and member states, important conditions, at least on paper, at least in the rhetoric, these are said to be important conditions for cooperation.
So the African Union calls for a permanent African seat in the UN Security Council. And this push has been on the agenda for quite some time. It was raised by African leaders already in 2010. And has since then become more and more of a burning issue. During his visit to Addis Ababa, China's foreign minister, Qin Gang, said that Beijing supports the African Union's greater representation and voice at the UN Security Council and other international organizations. But he made no direct reference to permanent representation. How should Qin Gang's comment be interpreted, and what are the interests of China in this matter? Fantu, maybe?
I think this is a very interesting topic, which the Americans also have picked up now. About a month and a half ago, there was a U.S.-Africa Heads of State Summit in Washington. They have floated that. I think one thing we need to understand right now is both on the American side as well as the Chinese side, everything is weaponized in terms of politically. Mm-hmm. So even if that was possible, being a member of the UN Security Council, that is going to be very symbolic because the other P5, the permanent five, are also the major donor to the African countries. So is it possible to forge a common African position in the context we are facing, you know, the elephant in the eye in many ways? You know, what would be African position within the Security Council in particular areas which you might offend one or two donors? You know, you might offend the Chinese or the Russians, or you might offend the French and the Americans. So I think for me, it is a very symbolic issue, whereas individual African members to the Security Council have made some noises, as you know, when the Kenyans were in the Security Council, they were the only one who really, when the vote came in against the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they were making a statement there, but collectively, the AU within the Security Council, I'm not quite sure what value it would have. That's my serious doubt. And there will be more a divide and conquer situation within Security Council. So, the P5 are economic powers, the P5 are military power. So African presence there, except to be pulled in different direction by the other five, I'm not quite sure what value it add to global politics issue within the Security Council.
Okay, thank you. John, Lisa, do you have any comment?
I couldn't agree more, actually. I think, actually, to be honest, I don't think it is in China's interest at all to allow any more permanent seats in the UNSC.
Exactly.
I mean, the Security Council is, after all, the institutionalization of great power management.
Exactly.
And African Union is not a great power. So China has no interests in doing that. And if it would ever happen, I would be shocked, actually. And if it happens, it would be very symbolic and nothing more than that.
Interesting. And so China and other geopolitical superpowers are also imposing, inducing, or coercing, depending on how you see it, their influence in Africa through culture, values, policies, and other so-called soft power categories. So what is soft power and how is China operating to achieve it in Africa? And I guess this is most definitely for Lisa.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the concept of soft power refers to foreign influence on values and visions in social and maybe also cultural development. And these areas are also most interesting in the Chinese cooperation, because, for instance, if we look at the foreign cultural institutes in the continent, it is still so that France is leading with the Alliance Française. The first ones were established already in the 19th century. But the most rapidly growing institution in the continent are the Confucius Institutes. And the first ones were established only in 2004, 2005 in Kenya, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. But now these institutes are spread all over the continent. And what is significant in this China model is that these institutes established in the university campuses. So although the content of the work is teaching maybe history, also other cultural issues, but they are immediately in contact with the growing new elite in Africa when they are situated in the campuses. When I have visited some of the major national universities in Africa, in all university campuses, you can see Chinese scholars nowadays. And I think that's going to be a very significant and long-term investment, enhancing also relations with the continent.
Okay, thank you. So let's also look at business, which is an important component. According to a 2017 McKinsey report, there were 10,000 Chinese enterprises in Africa, and they generated $180 billion a year in revenues. And this was estimated to reach $250 billion by as early as 2025. Now, that might, of course, have changed due to Corona. But anyway, from a business perspective, what are China's main interests in Africa? Is it merely about shipping commodities to factories in China? Or does China also have an interest in building local capacity, in expanding the value-adding sector of the manufacturing chains in Africa? Well, Jan, maybe you could start up with this question.
Yeah, I think in some sense, Santu already answered parts of that question initially when he... But I would repeat or say that I think it's also... I mean, in some sense, yes, it is a lot about commodities to factories, like you say, or that Africa is primarily exporting raw materials to China and then importing manufacturing goods from China. So it's a very uneven relationship, I would say, when it comes to... And I mean, we talk about Africa, China-Africa, but if we break it down, it's actually, I mean, four or five African countries that dominate this trade when it comes to exports to China. So it's South Africa, Angola, Zambia and the two Congos, and that's basically oil and minerals that they are exporting. And then when it comes to African imports from China, then you have the bigger markets where you can buy cheap Chinese consumer goods. So again, South Africa, but also Nigeria, Egypt and Ethiopia and so on. They are the largest importers of Chinese goods. So it's a very uneven trade relationship. So in some sense, yes, but I mean, that doesn't mean that states or countries are trying to kickstart industrialization or trying to move up the value chain. And I think we have the example of the special economic zones throughout various countries in Africa, but maybe Ethiopia is one of the better examples where they are intentionally trying to move up the value chain and intentionally trying to kickstart industrialization by emphasizing light manufacturing. And now I think their exports is over $500 million worth of manufacturing goods. It's quite low, of course, but it's also at the very initial stages. So there are indeed somewhere you can find intentions to move away from this dependency, but the dependency is still very much intact, I would say.
Fantu, do you have something to add?
It's clear. I think Joanna said it, but... One, it is the Chinese activities are really concentrated in a fewer bigger countries. So when we talk about Africa, we're talking about the big players in Africa. So that are basically a handful of countries. And secondly, I think my experience just working with the government in Ethiopia on industrial policy with regard to the industrial parks. Certainly, the Ethiopian government has a very clear and coherent industrial policy, which is, of course, falling apart right now under the current regime. But that's where the meeting of mind came together, where it is possible to develop local capacity building, particularly when the countries themselves have their own blueprints, they have thought about it. Secondly, if you take again Ethiopia as an example, the industrial park development was a way for China to enter the U.S. market through the Africa Growth Opportunity, AGOA, which is now suspended. So not only China, but other countries really invested in Ethiopia as a way to get into the U.S. market through the Preferential Africa Growth Opportunity Act. So again, it is a mixed bag, but I do say where countries have done their homework, African countries, where they have put together a coherent industrial policy, they can certainly take advantage of the relationship they will have with Africa. Otherwise, it remains like the old colonial relationship in terms of dependence on commodity, dependence on import from China, etc. So again, whether it's a deliberate policy or not, but where local capacity building really succeed when there is a coherent policy on the part of the recipient countries as much as possible.
See, and very interesting. And in 2017, China established its first overseas military base in Djibouti on the coast of the Horn of Africa. And in 2021, news broke that China was planning to install a naval base also in Equatorial Guinea on the African Atlantic coast. Also, China has also in other ways increased its military presence across Africa. I know you're not going to like this. In the wake of the Belt and Road Initiative, let's stick to the nomenclature. How do these military advances play along with the African Union's security agenda, the APSA, African Peace and Security Architecture? Fantu, perhaps?
Well, definitely, I think there has been a substantial change that has taken place on the security front, particularly since Ping came to power in 2012. And now more intense, now we have now a second term. So given the climate with the United States and Russia, literally the Chinese interest in security dimensions, particularly in Djibouti, the whole Horn of Africa issue has become much more intensified. And then, of course, you have the private army, the Wagner Group, which is also playing a significant role in the Russian side. There is a securitization of everything that's happening, the way I see. But even trade is securitized, investment is securitized. So there is the severe, intensive engagement by the current Chinese government with regard to security-related issue in Africa in general, as a competition to the kind of the Cold War, emerging Cold War that's going on between China and the Soviet, China and the United States, but also in the context of what we see right now in Europe. So I do see a greater engagement of China and the security front. To what extent it fit with the Africa peace security agenda, architecture remain to be seen, but I think they have basically weaponized everything, if I might say so, with a very intensive competition with the United States. So how would that complicate the security architecture, security agenda in Africa remain to be seen. I don't see it more positively at all. It more likely complicates the more other actors, become more involved in the African security issues, the problem will more likely get exacerbated. So it can becoming a playground, just as it was in the 1950s. There's the danger of the continent becoming a playground between its competing powers in the future.
John, you had anything to add?
No, not really. But I think it's also, Xinjiang mentioned the same thing, that there, I mean, just the fact that he mentions it, and the fact, just the fact that people are talking about the potential that Africa will become battleground, or yeah, it is, it's problematic, I think.
Yes, I think that for China, what is its major interest is stability in Africa, and because the because of the trade relations and business, I think that this like Wagner's presence, for instance, is not necessarily something that China is very, very happy about. And of course also in the within these geopolitical tensions and perhaps new kind of Cold War situation, also having friends in the international arena, like in the UN votings, for instance, is important to China. So good relations with the governments of UN member states is important. And I think that we already saw that in the UN voting, in the behavior of member states in the UN votings concerning the war Ukraine. And I think that it was maybe China that was more influential in the background of these votings than Russia itself. And that's why also the kind of security relations have an important political dimension, I would say.
Thank you very much. Well, this is a very broad topic and we could have continued for another half an hour here, but our 30 minutes are unfortunately up. So
That went fast.
your brilliance just overwhelmed us. What can we do?
Thank you very much for participating, everyone. So thank you and goodbye.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for participating. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.